When we just read the New Testament, nobody would even think that in the first century, at the time of Jesus, is anything similar to what we live in our life today. Of course, it was not a simple pastoral and agrarian society that we tend to project onto it, but then neither was it tremendously complex. Aside from those in political and religious positions, there really was no such thing as the super wealthy made up of commoners such as, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg. There wasn't any middle class or even upper middle class. But for us living in the United States, in a country that has had a thriving middle class, our first instinct is to conclude that scriptures have a substantially different meaning for us than to people that lived in the first century or even at any other period in their lives. This, of course, is challenging to us because while we might understand that Jesus was speaking to a first century audience, we question how exactly that applies to us living in the 21st century. For if we look at it from this perspective, then we might be tempted to discount scripture, which is a dangerous and slippery slope. That's because whenever we come across something that perhaps we don't like, or something that is difficult for us, or even something that we don't understand completely, then we can discount its value and then claim that it doesn't apply to us. Or does it? It is true that our society is dramatically different than that of the time of Jesus, but we can't forget that we're still very much human. And as the book of Ecclesiastes tells us, there is nothing new under the sun. Human beings still suffer from the effects of original sin, even if we've been baptized and that mark or stain has been removed. These effects make us susceptible to a full range of unhealthy emotions, such as, jealousy, envy, pride, among many others. And then it's usually followed by some fairly predictable, unsavory actions. Thus, the stories in the whole Bible resonate with us, even though their situations are different, precisely because they are stories about people and their interactions with other people. So we can see, even though we live in a dramatically different time and space, our basic needs, our basic understandings, and our functioning as people is really just the same. The gospel passage today troubles many faithful Catholics from a logical standpoint. If we cannot serve both God and mammon, and we're called to serve God, then by mutual exclusivity, we cannot serve mammon. Many people know the word mammon to mean money or material wealth or any entity that promises wealth. The fact is, in Benicia, in San Francisco, the Bay Area, or the United States, we're very wealthy compared to the rest of the world. So how exactly are we supposed to read this scripture passage and not throw our hands up in despair? Should we just empty our savings account or liquidate our 401ks, if there's any value in that anyways? Should we abandon our lives, move out into the desert, or check into some monastery? That would be ridiculous, not to mention impractical. How would we sustain ourselves, raise our family, or just get by? Or do we do as I originally put forward, just ignore the scripture as if it didn't really apply to us? That's so first century. We're enlightened now. We're much better off. Jesus could not have possibly meant that for us. Really, the text doesn't tell us to reject mammon as if it were some plague that needed a cure, but rather the emphasis of the text is upon excessive worrying or anxiety about our own needs in life. That's because when we seek wealth for its own sake, then it becomes a god in itself, which is why it is likened to God himself. It is like a drug, and each hit is less satisfying than the one before it. And for non-Christians, they seek this god and the material things it buys. They worry about their life, their physical appearances, and their possessions, and the accompanying social status. It is what drives them because, after all, they don't have the same goal of everlasting life. And indeed, even as Catholics, if we forget about God's directives, then we can find ourselves in this predicament as well. Is our allegiance to God and to God alone? Lip service is really very easy, especially when we come to Mass on Sunday. But do we actually practice it throughout the week in our day-to-day lives? Jesus tells us today that we need to not only serve him with our lips, but to do also with our actions. Can we trust God or have faith that he will provide us with the happiness that we need? Or do we rely on our own volition to get what we want? For Christians, it should be a wholehearted devotion to God. Jesus places the discussion within the context of anxiety and faith and trust. Do we trust in ourselves, our power, our ability to get things done? Are we excessively anxious about our physical needs? Or do we hand it over to God, who tells us no less than 3 times in this passage that he provides for us, and in no small way either? I have a very good friend back east who has several children. His wife, ever the pious one, the Mary in the family, is always content to put her faith in God, knowing that providence will come. He, on the other hand, the Martha in the family, can't sit by and let time pass. He has to provide for his family, feed them, clothe them, educate them, and all the other things that are involved in materially raising children. While he is also a strong believer in the providence of God, he knows that he has to be the instrument of God's will. Does he worry about how he'll provide? Yes. Does this give him some anxiety? Yes. Does it overwhelm him? No. The truth of the matter is that he is devoted, he devotes himself to God, and while he has an active role to play, God does not let him down. And because he trusts in God, God has not failed to give him the resources he needs. Are they exactly the resources he wants? Not always. Are they less than what he wants? Sometimes. Are they self-serving or excessive? No. That's because by orienting himself to Christ, he knows that whatever wealth he has accumulated goes also to the glory of God. I recall the one time that I went to Disneyland as a kid. My brothers and sisters all had a blast. I'm dating myself, but this is where the tickets were not passes. They were tickets. An A ticket would get you into a boring ride, such as a buggy trip down Main Street. But an E ticket, that's what you wanted, because that got you onto the Matterhorn, or to the Pirates of the Caribbean, or to the Haunted Mansion. So naturally, we gobbled up all those E-tickets first, and then at the end of the day, we had a pocket full of A-tickets. When we got home, we of course talked about the trip for days, but it soon lapsed into fond memories as we aged and moved on. Oh yes, we'd bring it up every now and then, but as we got interested in other things, they quickly took its place. That's not to say we don't have strong imprinted memories. After all, I still remember about those tickets. That's not it at all. But rather, the time we had then was a fleeting moment in time, and something that did not really define us in the long run. So the question for us is a family trip to Disneyland serving mammon or serving God? And in true Dominican tradition, all I can say is, it depends. A trip to Disneyland can serve God if it's cast in the proper light. Did we thank God for the opportunity for us to be able to go on this trip? Do we take the time to understand that the money earned for this trip was in itself a gift from God? The purpose then becomes a lesson on how God in his providence gives us lots of opportunities. Some might be strong family time together in the domestic church to honor God. It then becomes less fun for fun's sake and more fun for the lessons passed on to our children. Perhaps the impression would have been more indelible, more the work of formation as Christian children, than just for a trip, for the sake of a trip. From the outside, looking in, it's exactly the same. The difference is the focus on God and his providence. Certainly a lesson not to be just learned, but also retained. But how can we make a practical use of what Jesus is telling us? Money is something that is useful to us, but only at a secondary level. Its primary purpose should be to help us get closer to God. Now, let me repeat that. Its primary purpose is to help us to get closer to God. Money is really a gift from God that should be used as a tool to make us more holy and to bring us closer to Him. We could, after all, have been born in a developing country where the basics such as clean water, food, and electricity are scarce and expensive. And it was his providence that allowed us to be born into our current situation, one that finds us with more abundance than lack. The way we use money tells us a lot about how we value God. Does money buy us things that merely make us happy? Or does it achieve happiness in God? There's a difference. Does buying a new car bring us prestige? Or is it a method of transportation to help us to do God's work? The action is the same, but the intention is different. Must we do sports to increase our family's respect and honor? Or do we do it because being of sound mind and body allows us to be a Christian example to others? Again, the action is the same, but the intent is different. We could enumerate this forever, and we should, and that's good. And as we can see, we can accumulate wealth and not have it turn into the master that Jesus speaks of. But we must be willing to use that wealth as stewards, even as we go along for the ride. As St. Paul points out to his flock in Corinth, if they are good stewards and disciples of Christ, he will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will manifest the motives of our hearts. And then everyone will receive praise from God. It need not be for the church, in case we feel this would be a self-serving mission. But it can do many corporal works of mercy on its own if we so direct it. And that will bring us joy.